the Leading with
Love, Empathy, Action, and Humanities podcast.
Hello, hello, everybody. Welcome back to another awesome episode of Leading with Love, Empathy, Action, and Humanity. I am Alex Kirk, and with me, as usual, is Dr. Jessica Miller. We're very excited that you're here. And we're very excited today because our awesome guest is Dr. Anne Kalasak. She is a retired executive director. Welcome, Dr. Kalasak.
Thanks.
And she's going to tell us a bit about her leadership journey and how Leading with Love, Empathy, Action, and Humanity has helped her in this. So, Dr. Kalasak, just tell us a little bit about your background and your career path.
Well, I didn't teach for a very long time. I only taught for 5 years, mostly in middle school. But I did have an interesting job at one point where I drove around to parochial schools all around the city of Los Angeles. And so that'll come into play at some point when we start talking about equity, but that was an interesting experience. I started in Palm Springs Unified 33 years ago. I started first as a middle school assistant principal, and then I became a middle school principal. Then I volunteered to open a school. At that time, that was a time when all the students had to pass the California High School Exit Exam. And I offered to open a school for 350 students that had all failed eighth grade. And we put them on a separate campus. So I did that for a while. When the funding dried up for that program, I went to the then superintendent, Dr. Dietrich, and he said, what would you like to do? And I said, well, the continuation school principal is retiring, so as long as I can reimagine the alternative programs in Palm Springs Unified, I'll take over the continuation school. And he said, okay. So I did that. I was there for quite longer than I thought I was going to be, but that was a really great experience when we reimagined independent study. We brought on some virtual online at that time. And really got into homeschooling, elementary homeschooling. After that, I was asked to go to Desert Hot Springs High School as principal. That's where I met Jessica. And I was a principal there. And I loved that job. That was a great job. And I only left the high school because a director of curriculum instruction for secondary came up in Palm Springs Unified. So I applied and was given that position. I was there for only 4 years, and then I was asked to take on the Executive Director of Student Support Services for Palm Springs Unified. I got my doctorate at the University of Laverne in 2004. I also have had a couple stints, and currently I'm teaching at Cal State San Bernardino in their secondary credential program to train future teachers. In middle school and high school instruction. And then I coach Laverne doctoral students. So that's kind of what I've done.
Keeping yourself busy.
Yes. So
I have to say about Anne, and I don't want to embarrass you, Anne, but I have to say, I think it's important to let listeners know kind of before we go into your leadership journey and career path, how much you have really helped me in my career. I think you hired me in 2010, I think, or maybe 2009 or 10 or something.
2010.
And from that moment, regardless of where each of us ended up, you have remained just amazing mentor and friend. And I think it really speaks to our last episode, we talked about very strong female leaders, and you were definitely one of those for me and my mentor and my coach. And I've always appreciated it. So I just felt it was super important to kind of mention how amazing and wonderful you are. And I'm so glad that you're teaching future teachers, because I think that is your jam for sure.
Thanks.
You're welcome. And now I'm just going to shoot it back to Alex, but we had to say all the good stuff first. So
do you feel better? Okay. Do you feel better now, Jessica?
I do. I think people need to know, like, the relationships. I mean, the big part of what we talk about in the book and in our blogs is the importance of relationships. And I think that Anne just really
personified that for you.
Personified that so well. And I think it's important as we go into her leadership journey, just knowing that she took this time over 13 years that we've known each other to continue to build. And we're both in different places now than when we started, but we've really kept this kind of idea of supporting not only leaders, but women leaders in particular. And Anne's just really good at that. And so I think that that context going in, I'm going to shut up now.
It absolutely is. Those relationships are super key and important. And I could go on about Dr. Kalasek as well, but I'm not going to. But that leads seamlessly into this question, which is, Anne, who are some people who really influenced your journey that you felt really helped you evolve as a leader in your
career? Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was thinking about that question when you sent it out to me. You know, really one of the, as far as my leadership, just, you know, not even really talking about like my, the empathy and action, that piece of it, but really my leadership was really influenced by Dr. Dietrich. I mean, he really was the one who saw something in me that I don't think I saw in myself. And I think that's really important when, as leaders, we're developing future leaders, that tapping somebody on the shoulder and saying, you know, you'd be really good at this. Like, you, this is something that you need to develop. It's a strength. And not only do we need to do that with adults, but it really impacts how I work with teachers. And it does impact that piece of empathy, because we need to really focus on assets of individuals, because everybody has assets. And I think as teachers, we need to recognize the assets in our students. And I think as adults, we need to recognize the assets in people around us and help guide them in that path. So, and Dr. Dietrich, like, I mean, we were lucky in Palm Springs. He was our superintendent for 10 years. Like,
it's a long time for a superintendent.
It's a long time for a superintendent. But, you know, he got me involved in the doctoral program. It was interesting because I talked about starting Ramon Academy. So this, the, at that time, a school that had was serving 350 eighth graders across the entire district. So we took all the students from everywhere that had failed eighth grade. And I went and I asked him for that job. Like, I said, I really want to work with these students. And I remember at that time he said to me, well, you're really successful at the middle school where you are. And I said, yeah, but like those kids don't, they're going to be fine. Like they're going to be fine. And I really want to work with these students that are highly at risk. And he allowed me to develop that program the way I wanted to. And then when I went into alternative ed, I said, you know, I want to be able to do things differently. And he said, okay. So I think as a leader, it really is important to get out of people's way, like to let them really do what they want to do, what they have a passion for, support them and give them the support that they need. Because when we did remote, I mean, I got a remodeled school, I got everything. So he really supported me, but he also let me do what I wanted to do. So I would say really him. And then as far as, you know, really impacting my empathy, it was students and people in the community.
So a little bit about that, to kind of piggyback off that, building your empathy as a leader and that being your students and the people in the community. I know you're very empathetic just as a person anyway, but how did you really use that empathy within your leadership to build? Because I know some of the communities you worked in have not been maybe the easiest. And so how have you used that empathy in your leadership to build those relationships with your community?
Well, I don't know if it's using the empathy. I think the community and the students developed my empathy. So let me go back a little bit. To my story. So I mentioned, one of my jobs when I was in LA is, I had to go around to different parochial schools. Like, I was in a different school every day and I was teaching them computers. And one of the schools that I went to, here I am, like, you know, very born. I wasn't born and raised in the Midwest, but by Midwest parents. So white woman, Christian, I mean, pretty much as mainstream as you can get. one of the schools that I went to, I was the only white person in the school. So I just by being in that situation, I learned what it was like to be the only one that looked different. Like nobody looked like me. And that was kind of like my first journey. So I don't think I used empathy. I think I was taught empathy by the situations that I was placed in.
That exposure.
Right. Because you know, it's the stories and just my interactions with people that taught me that like my world isn't everyone's world. And so I did need to learn to understand and put myself in other people's shoes.
Which is so important. And I think the really, really getting to know the core of somebody is being able to, and maybe not always understand per se, we might not always really understand how another person walks in the world, but at least knowing that you don't understand and knowing that we need to develop this within ourselves is key, I think, to how we lead our organizations.
Knowing that it's just not the same, right? So just because that's your experience, and you know what that is realizing that other people have different experiences. And then as leaders and in education, trying to make the space where they feel accepted and comfortable and they can be successful.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Absolutely.
So Alex, I don't think we talked about who was answering or asking these questions. Did you want to continue with that?
Well, I can certainly do it. So like anybody else that's influenced your journey and how, you know, again, I know that you were a lot into your own equity work through your different jobs. So, you know, how did you help keep equity at the forefront of your work, or how did you incorporate it to make sure that you were providing equitable spaces for your work site? Your employees.
I would say staff and students.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important. I think it's listening, number one, right? So you need to listen to people's stories. And then you need to share those stories when it's appropriate with both students and with the educators that I'm working with and with teachers and staff. So I think it's important. I think in terms of equity, it's again, you were talking about the relationship, Jessica. So first of all, people have to feel safe with you to tell you their story. And then you need to hear their story. You need to really listen to their story. And then you need to share their story with people when it's appropriate. And I think that's how I keep equity in the forefront of the work. I mean, I really think, and I think where leaders struggle sometimes is I was lucky enough to be in my first situation between being an AP and a principal for 11 years. So I think people began to recognize that they were safe with me and they could tell me their stories and that I would share them when they were appropriate. But that doesn't happen overnight. And I think what happens is I think people are moving. So everything in our world is just moving so quickly right now that people don't take the time to really just say, yeah, like I'm going to just be here and I'm going to be, you can trust me. But when people are sharing their stories, especially when it comes to equity, they're not going to share them right away because they need to know that they can trust you. And that trust comes with, you're going to come to me with a request. I'm going to follow through with the request. I'm going to follow up with you. And then eventually you earn their trust and they tell you their stories. But I think that's how I keep equity in the front of the work is listening to the stories and then telling the stories.
I keep hearing like, authentic leadership qualities and being a vulnerable person and being receptive to that type of stuff as well. I mean, so it's more than right just going through the motions. It's letting people have that space that they can develop that trust and you get to know them better. But that's so powerful. I think we were talking about it in our earlier podcast, you know, yes, creating those spaces and just letting people feel like they are accepted.
Yeah, and I also think Yes. And I think there also needs to be the you need to feel comfortable enough as a leader to confront people when it's appropriate. You need to be courageous.
Confrontation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You need to be courageous enough to have that conversation, but you need to know when it's appropriate and do it respectfully.
Right.
Yeah. We don't want any amygdala hijacks, which we know what will happen if you come at somebody the wrong way. But I think that what you're pointing out is kind of that action piece.
Yeah.
Like when we're leaders and we're seeing some huge oppression issues and whatnot happening in our systems, and we sit back and don't confront, I think that's just so dangerous for leaderships to be able to allow their organizations to keep going like that. And I think we're seeing that a lot. So do you have, I personally have seen you confront beautifully some injustices in schools. You happen to be my principal for a long time, so I got to see some of this work. And I know we didn't send you this question, but kind of putting you on the spot a little bit. Is there a time that you can remember in your leadership where you did have to confront a social injustice and it went well and moved your organization forward? Or is there a time where it didn't go well, and what would you have changed in that situation?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting because we were just talking about confrontation. So where I was middle school principal, it was the time of school uniforms in middle school, when everybody in California thought that was going to be the panacea for helping middle school students feel good about themselves, and everybody would be on an even keel, and won't this be great? And because middle school students are going through such trauma. Mm-hmm. And I tell this story, actually, again, this is one of the stories I share over and over and over. Yeah. But we had this young man, and he was an eighth grader at the time. And first of all, he was tall. So he's taller than most kids in the school. And he's got red hair. So like, he sticks out to everyone, to kids, to teachers, to everybody. And he never came to school dressed in his uniform. And the teachers were really upset about this. And they would, and not only that, but he was in the GATE classes. So he was gifted in addition. So they were very, very upset that this kid never came to school in his uniform. And as principal, they wanted me to do something about it. They wanted discipline for this young man.
So typical.
Yeah. Because he wasn't wearing his school uniform.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm doing little kind of things like, you know, okay, maybe lunch detention or blah, 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 you know, these little kind of little things. And of course, it's not changing anything. He's still not coming to school in his uniform. So I investigate and I find out this young man's story, which I'll tell you in just a second. And of course, on our agenda for one of our staff meetings, so the whole staff's there, one of the agenda items is the school uniform policy and how we're going to enforce it. And when are we going to start suspending students for not coming to school in uniform?
Blah.
That's crazy.
So
crazy.
It was crazy. This is early, Alex.
When was this? The
1800s? Yeah, can we know the year of the when did this happen?
Okay, so let's say this is probably mid-90s.
Okay, wow. Maybe.
Okay, but yeah, still, that's not that long ago.
No, it's not that long ago. So late 90s, I'd say maybe mid-90s. So because I started there in 89. So I'm standing in front of this whole staff, and they mention this kid by name. For example, what about, like, he never comes to school in his uniform. What are you going to do about it? When are you going to start suspending him? So I said, so here's the story with this young man. He's homeless. He's living in a car. The fact that he gets this school at all is a miracle.
Yeah.
So whichever one of you want to come to my office tomorrow and issue this suspension, be my guest, because I'm not doing it.
Did any teachers show up in your office? I didn't think they did.
And it, you know, it's like, you know, it was just craziness.
It's kind of crazy. They didn't know that already as teachers. You would think that they would, you know, they would have known that, right?
Well, yes and no. Again, I think you think of the time. So here's the thing. So remember, he's a GATE kid.
So he's not fitting the social mold of who's generally homeless either.
Well, yeah. I mean, yes, he's not fitting the mode, but I think the other thing is it comes up with those, like, not listening to the stories, right? Because he's gay. So in your mind, gay isn't homeless.
Right. Right.
I mean, that's just what you said, Jessica. Yeah. So it's like they didn't even think to ask because
he's gay. Yeah. I think we miss a lot of stories in that.
Because we assume.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is when we're assuming, we're also a lot of times playing with our own biases or thinking through our own biases. Or no, actually, I want to say not thinking through our biases. We're letting our biases make our decisions. And that story, hopefully, when you told the staff, allowed them to kind of see, am I looking at this through a bias? Mm-hmm. Hopefully.
Well, we didn't even talk about that back then. Like, we didn't talk about, like, our conscious you know, I think really the first time that we started, that I can recall, really talking about our unconscious biases, it's interesting. It really had to do with, and a lot of people don't like her work, but at least for me, in my situation in Palm Springs, the Ruby Payne work.
Oh, the poverty work she does. Yeah.
You know, the poverty work was really mm-hmm. the first time, like, we started saying, yeah, you know, like these kids have resources. Like they bring something to the table. Like they have assets, and we're not accounting for that. So I think really that was that before we start talking about our unconscious bias in terms of race. I think that really, when I think back to my situation, was the first time as a collective group. You know, we started in Palm Springs. Trying to think, it was probably maybe around the same time, but there was a food fight on Palm Springs High School campus and between two different racial groups. And that made it all the way to the national AP that there was a race riot on our campus.
Yeah.
And that's when, as leaders, Dr. Dietrich turned to my good friend and Jane and Mills and said, okay, we need to do some diversity work, was what we called it. Yeah. And that was also about the same time.
Yeah.
So talking here a lot about, again, I'm going to call it again, authentic leadership and lost my train of thought.
You never lose a train of thought, Alex. That's not like you at all.
Happens occasionally.
Authentic, that's my MO.
Authentic leadership and having humanity in our work, basically, and seeing each other as people, not just as staff members, but also as students. And that really is important because you can't do anything, teach a kid or facilitate type of systemic change without really making those connections and having people feel that they can trust you and that can trust your direction. So, like, one of the last questions we got here, and is, you know, and especially because you do mentor people and you work at the University of Laverne, woohoo! What advice would you give to leaders or people who wish to create more equitable environments at their sites? What would you say? What do you say they would have to do to cultivate that kind of attitude? I know you said already about just listening, basically, and letting people teach you their stories and stuff. Anything else that you would advise leaders to do?
Well, I think it's the two things. So I think it's the assets, right? I mean, I think it's really both with staff and with students recognizing that everybody has assets, and that as a leader, it's up to you to cultivate the assets in your staff. And I think it's important for your teachers to cultivate the assets in your students.
I really like that you said that before, actually, and that you brought it back up again, because I feel it frequently. We're trying to point out deficits all the time, or we're trying to build people up in the deficit area, as opposed to playing to people's assets, you know, And I'm happy to talk about myself for a moment. I know I've got assets. I know that they're there. I know that I can do things. I feel like frequently I'm not good enough because I have deficits in these areas that I'm frantically trying to basically fill or come up with or work on. And of course, yeah, that's hard because they're my deficit areas. But you know what I mean? I do have assets, but I frequently feel like it's not good enough. You know what I mean? I'm going to have to be good at everything. And I can totally see how our kids could feel that as well. So I think that's a really important point, recognizing people's assets. And then, so yeah, if someone's better suited to this position or this thing to do, then let them go do it. Or like you said, you had a passion and your superintendent allowed you to follow that passion. Yeah, people will totally follow their passion. They're going to work 24/7 to make this come true. And that's out there. But yeah, we tend to systemically assign people different roles based on the needs of the system, but not based on what people are, you know. I see you shaking your head, nodding your head there. And it's kind of crazy when you think about it. Like, could we be a lot more productive by giving people or having people work together who really get on well and can facilitate that kind of change or whatever we want to do? So,
yeah, talking about systems in classrooms, and I know it's a whole nother podcast, but when we approach our students with an assets-based approach, it makes a huge difference in student outcomes, like marketable difference in the data that shows we're going at an assets-based approach because all of our students have assets. Mm-hmm. And like, right. So what work do we need to do with our staff to ensure that they're approaching it that way? You know, I think that's kind of what you just spoke to. And I think that's a big part of our work as leaders is helping our teachers to grow or our staff to grow and be able to approach students and staff and people in general, just humans, with the assets-based approach. I think that would change so many of our systems, but we're just talking about education right now. So,
but it's interesting because what just came to my mind is education changes slowly, right? Okay. So it doesn't adapt quickly enough. That's kind of, you know, I think when Alex said something, it really kind of triggered me to think of something. It doesn't, like, we have these predefined roles in education, and like the idea is, okay, you're going to fit like into this role when it might not even be your strength area.
Right.
And we don't allow people to think out of the box and say, you know, what if I tried this? You know, could I develop this program in the school? I mean, and I hate the word program, so that doesn't really.
Same. Yeah.
You know, but, you know, and I think even with students, right? I mean, if we, this is crazy, but I mean, at one point when I was probably about halfway through my career at the middle school too, like there was this gentleman, I don't even remember his name, but I remember his face. And he came to me and he said, you know, we're pinholing kids. Like this was like when the internet was just trying to burst open. And he's like, why don't we develop a situation where a kid can learn everything they need to learn by like developing their own path, like letting them go their own way. And it really made sense to me. Of course, we couldn't figure out a way to pull it off, but I mean, it's kind of that self-directed learning.
And I'm thinking about a story, like, again, a lot of our teaching is still so prescribed. There's only one way to show mastery of this material. I remember having a conversation just last year with a teacher who, the kid had awful writing. So I'm like, okay.
Like penmanship or like writing?
Like penmanship.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's causing this major, you know, it's a major, huge problem, right? For this assignment or something. So I'm like, fine. So let the kid type on his keyboard. Let him let him write the response. Oh, well, his writing's terrible on there too. I'm like, thinking outside the box. I'm like, okay, great. So you know what? Then let him come and give you orally what he's thinking about. So he can tell you what he knows. And the teacher's response was, I don't have time for that. I don't have time to have this kid come to my desk and do this. And I'm just
this one minute. Oral.
Yeah. Like, I mean, and that flat out unwillingness and there was a hint of unreasonability. Like I was being unreasonable, basically. Like, this is unreasonable. I can't be expected to do this. But just like, so basically this kid's kind of screwed. If he's got awful penmanship and you're not willing to read his badly typed answer on the computer, then how else is this kid supposed to be successful?
He's going to fail is what's going to happen.
That you're
and
moaning
it's a big
about,
part of our society. Right,
right? But you're moaning about how he's not being successful. But basically you're totally throwing this back on the kid. And I just thinking about that is, you know, we're talking about playing to people's assets and letting people learn and show how they're learning in the way that is most suitable to them. But yeah, unfortunately, many of us, a lot of the system stifles that. It's really unfortunate because our kids are smart. They know lots of stuff. And just because they're not performing in the way we want them to, we just think they don't know anything. We're willing to just wipe them off the table. It's very sad.
And we don't take the time to listen.
No.
Listen to them. Yeah.
Listen.
It's
to
so
them.
True. I just did a whole training on that on Tuesday, like 8 hours of just like how to learn it. How to listen to people. And it's a lot. I think it's harder than we think it is, but I also think it's very trainable. And it's also something that we can not only model as leaders, but follow up with our folks also and really guide and teach them how to do that. Cause I don't think it's something that is natural, I think, to a lot of people and not something that's usually taught in leadership prep programs because we're so worried about budgets and schedules and all this managerial stuff instead of really leading. So,
yeah, that was another thing I think that really impacted me was going through a week long cognitive coaching training.
Yeah.
Because that really teaches you to listen and to ask questions and to allow people to find their own answers.
Mm-hmm. And then support them in those answers, right? Yeah. As a leader.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the one thing we do with kids is, we, you know, when you talk about equity, we force our solutions on them.
Right. Oh, don't we ever? That's the great educational system right there, the American educational system.
Right.
There's, you know, it's just, so not only are we forcing solutions on them, but we're not allowing them to even explore their own strengths or their own solutions. And it's a system broken.
Yeah. The one that drives me crazy is the getting your parents to sign your agenda.
Girl.
It's like, okay, like I don't see mom. You know, I don't have a dad. I don't see mom.
I forged She's my working. Signature.
And it's this kind of thing that are very systemic in and I think it doesn't seem to be a big deal to the power groups because generally we're okay with these things. It's the same idea as with adults as asking for maiden names on forms, like the amount of inequity in just asking for a maiden name. I mean, that assumes so many things from the normal class. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with like, why can't their parents just sign a permission slip or a gender or whatever it may be, right? When in reality, you're not trying to understand this child's reality right now.
Right.
And you're going to shut it down and you're going to say they can't go on the field trip or they're not going to get their 10 points for their agenda. That's really my favorite. Like all of these things. And like, it really does come down to that humanity piece of understanding that our students and our staff are in very different circumstances than most white middle-class teachers were raised in.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, well,
amen.
Well, Dr. Kalasek, thank you so much for joining us today. Any closing remarks you'd like to make?
I don't think so. Just, you know, to, I think just to listen and to keep your eyes open and just to really understand, just, you know, to make sure that you people, the kids and your staff feel comfortable telling you their stories and then helping them find what works for them in their situation because everyone's situation is different.
Awesome. Well said. Yeah.
Oh. All beautiful.
All beautiful, Jessica.
Different and all beautiful if we listen to these stories. And
absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So once again, thank you so much, Dr. Kalasek, for joining us today. Jessica and I are really thrilled that you could make the time to come and speak with us.
Totally. We really were.
Well, I love to talk on this topic. So anytime.
Oh, we'll have you back, I'm sure.
Oh yeah. Don't make promises like that.
Because any more podcasts we can talk about. Everybody out there, remember to check out our website, leahumanity.com, for blogs, more podcasts, and other interesting tidbits, and more about us. And then follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, LEA
Humanity. And TikTok.
Oh, and TikTok. I forgot one.
And LinkedIn. Love, empathy, action on all the socials. Awesome.
This has been Leading with Love, Empathy, Action, and Humanities podcast, hosted by Dr. Jessica Miller and Alex Kirk. Production by A Serious Production. For more information, please go to www.leahumanity.com. That's www.leahumanity.com.